Titus chapter 2. Titus 2. But speak thou the things which become sound doctrine, that the aged men be sober, grave, temperate, sound in faith and charity and patience. The aged women likewise, that they be in behavior as becometh holiness, not false accusers, not given to much wine, teachers of good things, that they may teach the young women to be sober, to love their husbands, to love their children, to be discreet, chaste, keepers at home, good, obedient to their own husbands, that the word of God be not blasphemed. Young men likewise exhort to be sober-minded, in all things showing thyself a pattern of good works, in doctrine showing uncorruptness, gravity, sincerity, sound speech that cannot be condemned, that he that is of the contrary part may be ashamed, having no evil thing to say of you. Exhort servants to be obedient unto their own masters, and to please them well in all things, not answering again, not purloining, but showing all good fidelity, that they may adorn the doctrine of God our Savior in all things. Let's pray. I thought before we go back into the practical ways that a courting couple should be spending their time in their courtship, it would be good to not forget that God's Word has some things to say to young men and young women, the kinds of things they ought to be attending to. For example, in verses 4 and following, the older women are exhorted to teach the younger women, presumably to prepare them, both in marriage and for marriage, that they should be sober. This is to be serious, to be single-minded, to be focused on the things of God, to have a proper sense of priority in life, to be grave. So this is to be to have gravity, to appreciate the seriousness of life and of eternity, of the things eternal, not to be frivolous and foolish and frothy, that they would love their husbands, that they would love their children. That always struck me as, it probably sounds peculiar to, you know, young married women today, so this older lady is going to teach me how to love my husband or how to love my children. But obviously there's things to be learned. To truly love someone is to love all of that person, including their spiritual and eternal welfare. And I think our older women have something to contribute here and sometimes are a little hesitant to do so. So there should be this multi-generational approach to training. To be discreet, so in other words, to not be froward, not to be bold, to be discerning, to be subtle, not in a negative way, to be chaste, the idea of purity, modesty there. Keepers at home. We were talking about this at a family we were visiting yesterday, and my wife and I met a lady in early days of our marriage, and she gave us her business card. And it had her name and address and phone number, and it said, you know, for her, the title, Keeper of the Home. So that was her business, to be home and to run her home, under the leadership of her husband. So I thought that was kind of neat. So a keeper of home, not here, there, and everywhere, taking care of everyone else's problems and neglecting what needed to be done at home. And how to be good. Obedient to their own husbands. And the key to this whole section, that the word of God be not blasphemed. In other words, it's not about a well-run home. It's not about a good reputation. It's about the Lord. It's about the witness that we present to the world as Christians about Him. And if they see us living disorderly and worse, it brings ill repute not only on ourselves and our families, but especially upon God and His Word. And then young men are exhorted to be sober-minded. So the same word used there for the men. A pattern of good works. Isn't that interesting? That young men should already be examples of good works to younger people. So, you know, that's quite a tall order already for our young men, that you should already be leading the way for younger brothers and sisters and young people in general. doctrinally, pure. So the men should be already in their younger years stocking their minds with good sound teaching, developing their awareness of what God has to say from the Word. They're going to be leaders someday, so this is something they should be preparing. Gravity, so the same sense of weightiness, not foolish and, you know, swashbuckling, whatever you want to call it, swaggering. Sincere, say what you mean what you say, speak words of soberness and truth. Sound speech. So in other words, what you say should be in accord with Scripture, not the latest fad or fashion or spiritual wind of doctrine that blows. And all these things, you know, the sound speech, that it can't be condemned, that those that are of a contrary part may be ashamed, having no evil to say of you. So Titus is saying that everybody's going to agree with you, but you ought to live in such a way that nobody has a ready handle to hold on to accuse you of wrongdoing or wrong thinking. And then it goes on to talk about servants and so on, which is important in its own right. So these are some of God's priorities as far as things we should be doing to preparing ourselves for guiding families, guiding a spouse, being a spouse, and so on. Okay, we left off last time, you'll recall, talking about practical ways that people ought to be spending their courting time. So far, the discussion has primarily, and rightly so, revolved around spiritual matters, spiritual preparedness, what kinds of studies, what kinds of materials, how much parental involvement, oversight, development. Let's expand on that list. what other kinds of things should they be doing or discussing? What would you want to see, young people, in yourself and in a courting partner before you're ready to say, I do? What would you consider to be ready? What sorts of things would you want to have covered before you're ready to commit an entire lifetime to this certain somebody else? Shar?
Working together.
Okay, can you be more specific? Just give examples.
I don't care, physical labor, whether it's going to the fence or, you know.
Okay. And what do you hope to gain from that?
You can see their persistence in do they look out right away, or, you know, can they work hard? Are they willing to work hard? Do they complain a lot? Do they enjoy work?
So their attitude regarding work?
Yeah.
Can we learn anything else from this? So not only your attitude toward work, but your motivation in work. How, let's press these a little further. What kinds of things would you want to be seeing under these two categories that you would be satisfied that this is making sense? Like, how would you know someone's attitude is right? What sorts of qualities do you want to see?
Cheerful.
Good. So you want to see cheerfulness. I mean, there's some hard workers who are just grumpy. They'll do it because they have to, because they get paid to, whatever, but Their attitude stinks. Yes?
That's the best of their ability.
Good. So,
quality.
Yeah. Are they doing it just to get it done? Or are they really seeking to, like you said, to use their abilities? And by saying that, you recognize right away, I hope, that people's abilities vary. And we need to keep that in mind. I would often say to students that I had in school, I would much sooner hire a student who works their heart out and can only manage a C than hire a student who is exceptionally gifted, lazy as all get out, and manages to pull A's all the time. I'd much sooner know that the person that's working for me is somebody who's using everything they have, you know, to the glory of God. That to me is way more important than native ability. What other things are we looking for here?
Maybe dedication to see if they, you know, persevere until the job's done.
Good. Dedication to the work, and not only, you know, the idea of perseverance. I know I didn't spell that right. Should be an extra letter in there. But I would also say, you know, not just persevering to make sure the thing gets done, but, you know, do they get discouraged easily on the way? Right? I mean, there's a lot of people you probably know who start like a house on fire. Right? And they'll see that the project gets done eventually. But somewhere between there and there, something happens. And marriage is a lot like that. We can start off like a house on fire too, and we'll stick it out to the end. But that doesn't mean, you know, if you're not persevering throughout with a good attitude, that things are gonna work out. So, you know, not just perseverance to the end, but dedication in the sense of consistency. You know, that just speaks up. What about in the realm of motivation? What are you looking for? How would you discern that somebody is doing something to the glory of God? What sorts of qualities would you be looking for? How would you know, as a courting partner or as a parent, that that's what makes this person tick? Good. Okay, that might be, not always, but a lot of times, what is the word? Initiative. They simply take the initiative. They have something internal that motivates them. Isn't that what we look for in our children? Right? It's one thing for us as parents to be pointing them in the way of God, discipline them toward the way of God, instructing them in the way of God, but isn't it a big relief when your child is pulling in the same direction, when there's an internal godly motivation, and then you're just, you know, working with that rather than trying to instill that in a person. So initiative, what else? Yes?
I call it observant of need, but the modern term would be proactive.
Okay. Could you unpack that just a little bit? How would that show a godly motivation?
Well, they're not so concerned with themselves and then waiting to be told, but they're observing others and looking at need and being considerate. So they're able to anticipate need and, you know, what might help someone, you know, bring them comfort as opposed to myself comfort, or, you know, aid and help instead of, you know, waiting for somebody to help me.
So the idea is we not only get started, because you can get started in a selfish way, right, is what you're suggesting, but by proactive you're meaning aware of others and taking the initiative regarding others. Because these can be very different. People can be up, going, you know, boom, right off the bat, persevere, finish, but it could be totally selfish. Whereas this, you know, what Michael's describing is proactive. It's an umbrella sensitivity, not just to me, my goals, my work, this, but it's being sensitive to those around us, including our courting partner, Brian.
So, in meshed in with proactiveness would be teamwork, which would indicate less selfishness.
Okay. Now, this is actually an important distinction because you can have one of the two courting persons being a self-starter, showing initiative, sensitivity to others, but what about the other person? You know, if there's no connection between you, if that other person isn't meshed with these same sensitivities, the same way of self-starting and motivation and looking out for others, you're going to end up in a big problem, in a big hurry. If one person's very selfish and the other person is this way, that's going to be tough sledding all the way through, because this person's going to have to be dragging the other person into that frame of mind constantly. So how well do you actually work together attitudinally, motivationally, as well as your skill set? Okay, these are very important considerations. Scott?
Being able to, along all these lines here, is the ability to lead, the ability to be led.
Good.
And teaching. Because a lot of people will lead other people.
Can't make suggestions.
And won't teach. And a lot of people will lead and will never be taught.
Very good. So you can see the two, you know, it's like a bicycle built for two, right? They have to work in tandem. You need primarily the man to be the leader, the initiator, but you also need a person who's teachable. You need somebody who's willing to be under authority. And to, so even in the division of labor, when we're talking about physical labor, there needs to be a sense of who's running this show. Who's the engine, who is the caboose, or however you want to phrase it. I'm not trying to demean anyone. We're talking about distinct roles. And if you're going to have a competition in a courting partnership about who's leading and who's being led and who's taking the initiative and who's not, that's probably going to project for a lifetime of that same confusion. There has to be clear direction in a relationship. Which, by the way, I hope you men are listening really well to this part. You know, being willing to be a leader means already now preparing yourself to be so. And I can't emphasize enough what a great responsibility that is. Stocking your mind with biblical knowledge, honing your skills, whatever they may be for your life's calling. Just your attitude toward work, toward life, you've got to be out front. You can't expect the person you marry to be carrying the water. That's just not only ungodly, it's unmanly. And your wife, your courting partner, if she is what she ought to be, will flourish under that kind of atmosphere and will wither when you're tied to a man who has to constantly be prodded, constantly be poked, constantly be encouraged to get going, to be leading, to start devotions, to be on top of things. That's like a ball and chain. The woman's already got enough things to do without needing a guy to be pushing and prodding and reminding all the time to be a leader. And ladies, likewise, okay? I forget what old writer said this, but it was a very thought-provoking... Oh, it was Benjamin Palmer, a very godly writer from the South, who did a lot of excellent work. I highly recommend his work on families, on marriage. They're easy to find if you just... Benjamin Palmer, his name is. But anyway, in a thing on marriage, he said something very insightful. He said, single women voluntarily give up some of their independence when they marry. I don't think he said some. Give up their independence when they marry. And when you think about it, yes, you're under your parental headship, but you have a little more leeway. You know, you're under your father's authority, and as you get older, you know, there's more and more decisions you make on your own, and all of a sudden you basically forfeit a lot of that. when you place yourself under the authority of a husband. Now, in our society, you don't forfeit a thing. Okay, you're equal partners. This is a committee project. You know, it's 50-50 and all that stuff. But biblically speaking, you're giving up a great deal of independence. Are you ready for that? Are you ready for that conscious decision that you're placing yourself not under the father you grew up with, but now under this man, whatever he is? You're willing to be led by him, to obey him, to follow him, respect him, and take your cue from him. Well, that, you know, if I were you, as young ladies, I wouldn't settle for the first guy that comes along unless he's well on his way toward this.
I think, too, I've seen a couple different ways, but sometimes the guy will take his headship or his leadership role to the extreme and not count the attributes of his mate.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be a difficult situation, too, where they said, well, I'm the boss here and this is how it's going to go.
Right.
And, you know, it'd be like me going into Char's garden and saying, this is, it's all green there, it looks like weeds to me, and I'm going to till it.
Mm.
Well, I don't think that's probably going to work too well, even though it may have been my decision, and I may have gotten some weeds.
Yeah.
So
let's unpack what you're saying, because this is very important. And I don't know if you're all going to agree with this, but you should. Never mind. What you're saying is true 100%, but it's not the whole story. A wise husband would do exactly what Scott is suggesting, and that is you recognize the gifts and calling of your wife. God specifically assigns certain things to the woman and to the man. So being a leader, being the head of your home, does not mean you assume all those responsibilities yourself. You would be a fool to do so. The very complementary nature that God created, that He woven into the difference between men and women, would be stymied and frustrated by us trying to run everything. So a wise husband and a godly husband would recognize the giftedness of his wife in what areas and what things, recognize the role that God has assigned, not him, and honor that. However, and here's the little bit of layer I want to put over the top of that. As the husband, you are responsible for the whole thing. That doesn't mean you do the whole thing, but that means the buck stops here. So even in those areas that you cede to your wife, in those areas of responsibility and delegation that you give to your wife or that the Word of God gives and you recognize, you're still in a general sort of way the overseer. So for example, just to use a practical example, let's just say your wife is good with numbers and keeps the checkbook or whatever, is the finance manager. The husband should at least be generally aware of the state of affairs, not maybe, you know, following every nickel and dime, but, you know, there should be a certain confidence in let's just say, the wife's ability to do this, but there should be a general oversight of all those areas, even the ones that you've given to your wife. Do you follow that? That's part of being a headship. If we don't do that, if we simply say, okay, I've got my area, and you've got your area, and that's the way we run things. You realize the difficulties here. Without even trying, you have basically eliminated part of what the husband's role is. And a lot of Christians thinking to honor each other's gifts and calling fall into this, and a lot of stuff falls through the cracks. So husbands, we have a general oversight of the entire family, including the stuff that we exclusively delegate to our spouses. Okay? So don't just say, whew, good, I handed that off, done. Okay? That's her thing. If she screws up, it's all her fault. No, I'm afraid it isn't. It's ours. So, and this, of course, takes delicacy. This takes wisdom. This takes sensitivity. You don't want to go barging in to the section you've given her and running it anyway. You don't want to be criticizing and nitpicking. Well, I didn't do that. We weren't brought up that way. If you're going to give something, give it. And then your oversight should be precisely that. A general oversight, a conversation about the general scheme of things, and then we leave it at that. And this doesn't mean that these roles are necessarily set in stone. It could be that, you know, 6 months, 2 years into the marriage, it's like, you know what, we need some adjustments here. I'm recognizing gifts in you I didn't see. I'm recognizing deficiencies in me I didn't see. You can negotiate and discuss and come to a godly, wise decision about maybe some shifting here needs to be done. But that doesn't change the oversight role the husband has. Okay? We're all agreed on this? Okay, that's pretty important. I would like us to now, okay, these are great. Let's think about specific activities, specific work-related activities that actually make the most sense. So in other words, I'm asking us now to go to the ground level specificity. You said build the fence. Quite frankly, to me that wouldn't be very helpful because I don't have a lot of places to put a fence in. Now you could learn a lot of this from that. But what I'm asking you now is, okay, given a limited amount of time, you know, maybe building a fence makes perfect sense in your setting, something else would make sense in my setting. I'd like to hear, in the setting you're in, what work activities you think would be most beneficial and why. What do you want to learn from them, Brian?
Well, I think part of the purpose of courtship is to do life together.
Yes.
So, in view of that, and this is probably what you were just saying, we need to do what would be coming in life together for the particular couple. So if you're calling this carpentry, there may be all the staff. If you're calling this husbandry, you may be doing that.
Now, this is what I'm looking for. Okay, if you're marrying a farmer, gals, you may not be a whiz at farming, you may have never been on a farm in your life, but it seemed to me that it would be a good idea to start learning. At least to develop an interest, an understanding, when you discuss what role you will have in this project, in this calling of your husband, are you fit for it? Are you a farmer's wife? You know, there's been some pretty not good fits in the past. You know, two people who loved each other greatly, both feared the Lord. The one had about as much interest in what the other was doing as black and white. That doesn't always work too well. You want to be able to at least enter into the world of your husband's calling to some extent. Now, I know that's not always totally possible. You know, there's just so much you can do that. And I'm not saying, you know, two doctors have to be married or two pharmacists have to be married. I'm not saying that. But part of that, what we talked about way earlier, low maintenance, means there should be some facility, some ability, some relative ease with which you can enter into your husband's calling and that he can understand your world, or at least takes initiative to at least understand your world, if not able to do it, at least to have some sense of empathy and sympathy. Okay, so realism. I don't want to just give this guy a project. I mean, I can learn some of his basic work skills, but as Brian was suggesting, let's try to get as close to what life will actually look like in your particular setting and see how that goes. So let's throw out some, give me some imaginary callings. Well, give me some real callings that a person might have and how that would look as far as actual things you do together. Let's use our imaginations here, or just use your own situation. You are thinking about this as your calling in life. What would make sense to do together in view of that?
I'll start off with Rochelle and I had some very good times when Liz is after we were married, but she came and worked with me on the job. Kind of unfortunate really have her doing that. But
now that wasn't just because she was cheap labor. Okay. Now, when you were courting, would you have suggested you'd give her a hammer and nails? And
we actually kind of entered more into her world with butchering chickens and growing gardens and stuff like that.
Okay. Why would that be helpful?
Because we understood more of the way each other worked. And then you understand also more of the world the other person is in.
Why is that important?
Just like Christ, who came here, suffered the temptations that we do, and is able to have compassion because he has been like that as we are.
We listening? We're all listening here?
You can enter into and have empathy. And,
yes.
Understanding.
How many husbands, right? They come home from work. What have you done all day? I was out. You know, why do they say that? Because they don't have a clue
what you did.
What even is her role? They're looking maybe at some stuff on the floor. Maybe a picture is hung wrong. There's a little bit of mess from the toys. It's like, that to them is the whole picture. Well, you wouldn't react that way if you actually took a turn feeding or minding baby to give your wife a couple extra hours of sleep or preparing breakfast when she's been up all night with a sick child. You'd think a little differently if you kind of entered into your wife's world a little bit and began to really understand in a way that you can truly sympathize. That's why this gets very dangerous. It's not only that you don't have oversight, but you end up not being sympathetic. Right? It's a typical husband who comes home and says, I'm done for the day. You know, snaps his fingers and waits for the rest to happen. You know, I've seen so many women bristle. Oh, so you don't work. You know, if you don't have a job outside the home, oh, your wife doesn't work.
Five things, five positions that I
carry. Yeah, I mean, but I mean, how many times have we heard that, right? Oh, your wife is home all day. Yeah. So that means she must have loads of time to do stuff for other people because she's just home. It's like, okay, that shows a lot of understanding, right? Let me give you a very practical example of where this was very important. In the early days when I was in New Jersey, we tried to provide the congregation with as many things to edify them as possible. But then we noticed that there were certain functions, especially during the week, that were not well attended. And some of the constituents were getting very discouraged, but then all of a sudden we reminded ourselves, that, wait a second, Pastor, didn't you preach a series of sermons on being a husband, being a wife, godly rearing of the children, how first responsibilities first? That people are doing that. They're staying home and taking care of their families, not running to every church activity. So we finally came out and publicly said, we're providing these things with the understanding that you shouldn't feel obligated to be at them all. You know, choose the things that are most fitting for your situation, but understanding that you're doing your calling, rearing your children, instructing them, trying to have an orderly. So there is that. Okay?
One thing I've noticed in just in life in general is that, you know, the daughters are going to pick a guy probably like their fathers. You know, that's their example.
Of course.
The sons are usually going to try to pick a woman like their mothers. Okay.
Keep going. This is good.
And one thing I've noticed, especially in society today, is that one, fathers aren't contributing to their sons' abilities. You know, they send them off to school, they get a paper job, really don't know how to fix the step, really don't know how to do the mechanics. Not to say that everybody should know how to do that, but part of their role in life is going to be maintenance.
We've outsourced training.
Yeah, and women, vice versa. Hey, I get, you know, 10,000 meals down at the grocery store in the frozen food section, and my husband will be satisfied every day of the week.
Yeah.
But you don't know how to boil water.
Right.
there's a lack here somewhere, you know, right. And so multitasking, having a girl understand some mechanical ability just so she can help her husband,
yeah.
And vice versa, having him be able to know how to cook can really help her out when she gets hit by a spider. we're saying that for a man right now.
So a certain level, and of course we're not going to have an ironclad rule, but a certain level of practical skills. Now, we work together. You give me ideas all the time. You start off and then I get this big balloon idea. I'm going to venture on dangerous territory here. Okay, so I'll give a disclaimer up front. What about women and college education? Let me just throw a stink bomb in the middle of the room and ask you what you think. Does it make sense for women to go to college?
What are they going for?
Okay, good.
Purpose.
So, purpose. Follow up with that. What would be legitimate in your mind or what would not be?
If a woman is going to college for the express purpose or learning the express purpose of a trade or a career, I would not say that would be not very helpful.
Well, I
would feel it for you.
Do what?
What about women gynecologists?
Do what?
We should have women nurses and women doctors and things like that too. So.
Women gynecologists.
Nathan?
I was just going to say, what if they're not called to be married?
Okay.
They might need to have training for a job.
Or their husband was to pass away early and they have to support the family.
Okay.
I would look like practical skills. You know, a girl could go to college to be teacher or nurse. Okay, both of those have indications that she's going to be working during the family experience, but also it could be that the teacher mind could be, I'm teaching my own kids.
Okay.
And also nursing is, I know enough people that definitely need nursing at home.
Yeah.
Practical skills would be a thing I would look at. Now, if it's going to be a high-end corporate business job that they're going to get an engineering degree for a woman, that I would pencil questioning. Practical skills, though, that can be used in or out of the home.
Okay.
It's different, I would feel.
Isabel?
I think a girl should try to learn things that she can get at home. Like, if she is going to learn something new, it should be something she can get at home.
Okay.
Like, if her mom is 31, she does things at home, sells things.
Okay. Anybody else want to chime in? Brian?
One more thing. Of course, Kevin Swanson's been poisoning my mind. He is questioning the concept of college altogether, where you group a bunch of young people generally all together. He would suggest, and I think that is rightly so, it would be better to get back to more of a apprenticeship or mentorship paradigm, where you would actually go work with someone who's a master of their trade.
Mm-hmm.
And that would work for both boys and girls,
right.
Whatever college you're going for.
Of course, we're now going into a theoretical field because we don't have a lot of that happening. Although it's interesting to me that in the medical training my son is getting, year three, it's precisely what they do. They follow doctors around, shadow them 24/7, and
if anything, it's coming back.
Yeah. People are realizing that this is the way to go.
The college isn't working.
Which, as a matter of fact, is the rabbinical way of training from the start. Mm-hmm. It was Jesus' way of training his disciples. He didn't send them off somewhere. You walk with them. Michael?
Yeah, I was trying to figure this out myself because I challenged my thinking. I could say something very controversial as well.
You may as well. Everybody else says.
Yeah. I think what it comes down to when you talk about calling, capacity, deficiencies within the God-ordained construct of, you know, a man or woman being married, their chief goal is to raise a godly household together. Hopefully have children if they can. If they can't, maybe they adopt children, or, you know, that's something they don't know when they get married. But there would be something like, let's say the woman was gifted and talented and could be a neonatologist MD. She would have to understand that her ambitions and goals were subordinated to the husband and to the Lord and the confines and construct of the household, so that if it worked out that she could juggle that and raise children, which I kind of doubt, she would have to be willing to subordinate her wishes and her goals to the husband and to the Lord. And that might not be easy, and that might not be real popular amongst the, you know, the get-ahead women, you know, go out and conquer the world and
I can assure you, it will not be popular. It reminds me of a beautiful little anecdote that illustrates what you're saying. I don't know a lot about Margaret Thatcher. I've heard some fairly negative things more recently about her, that she wasn't necessarily a Christian, although she sometimes supported some things that would lend you to think, but she also didn't support some things that you would hope she would have. But having said that, during an interview, when she was Prime Minister of Great Britain, somebody asked her, what's it like at home? She says, when we're at home, my husband is the head of the home, and I fold socks. So here she's the Prime Minister of the country, right? The head official. But when I'm home, my husband's the head of the home, and I fold socks. Yeah. But I mean, there's a certain admiration you have for that attitude. She understood, you know, a certain role she had in this setting and a role she had in that setting, and to her there wasn't an inconsistency between the two. Now, I'm looking at the clock. Let me give you some principles, or principles slash considerations for you to think about in this realm, okay? And see if we can't come to some consensus, because I think several of you have brought up very important points. Now, mind you, I don't know how many, well, some of you have been from different parts of the country, lived in different places of the country. You realize that the whole issue about women and secondary education is also a very regional one. There are certain places in the country where it is expected. There are certain places in the country where it's very much frowned upon. There are certain places in the country where it's a relatively indifferent matter. In the Northeast Coast, there is a bizarre and I think very unhealthy push that most people get a college education regardless. So you see, the college is stuffed with people, many of whom have no idea why they're there, some of whom think it's a grand party financed by their parents, and all kinds of things like that. Now, I'm painting with a very broad brushstroke. I found that in other places in the country where we've lived, it's actually looked at as a negative for anybody to go to college for reasons you know brought up. You know, the environment and this and that. I think we told you our families stand as far as living away at home, from home. We're not in favor of that, precisely because of the atmosphere that exists. But those are all side things. Let me throw out some considerations. First of all, a person's giftedness. And I would suggest this is for men and women alike. Is it possible that women who have certain gifts and ability should use them in areas that we might generally agree are appropriate for women to have? For example, I am very thankful that there are women OBGYN doctors. I'm not comfortable with men examining that aspect of my wife's health. I would much prefer a woman being doing that. How many of us don't go to midwives? We would not be very comfortable necessarily with a male delivering our children. We're very thankful there are women who are trained in that skill. Now, not every woman necessarily can do that. Not every woman can be a nurse. Not everyone can be a doctor. So I think, first of all, we need to assess giftedness. Now, I'm not saying that's the only thing. It's one thing. You know, we shouldn't necessarily waste gifts, and we shouldn't try to make gifts that we don't have. Second of all, and I'm not putting these in order of priority, so please don't take them as such. The sense of calling. Is a woman uniformly called to be married? I think all of us can recollect in church history women who were single or who were married, but who shared a calling with their husband, let's say for mission work, or for doing some kind of work on a mission field. I think of Amy Carmichael, for example, and her calling, which it appears from all instances to be of the Lord, to be out far from home doing mission work for the Lord's kingdom as an unmarried person. So we can't say, I think we can't say categorically that all women are called to be married and that all women are called to prepare in just that area. But another consideration that I find is very much lacking, especially in Christian schools of all places, I don't know the exact statistics, I'm going to throw out what I think is a ballpark figure. Probably 9 or 9.5 out of 10 women end up being married. Even those who go to college or whatever end up being married. I think the consideration when we see that is going back to something you said, Scott, and that is, at the very least, shouldn't we be preparing our women for that which they are most likely to do, rather than for that which they might do? So even if a girl or a woman goes off to college, that does not mean that they shouldn't be thoroughly prepared to be a wife and a mother. Because if you just look at it statistically, very few women don't end up in that role. So we would be ignorant not to consider that. So whether or not a woman has certain gifts or abilities, a certain calling or not, doesn't negate the likelihood, strong likelihood, that she'll be occupying a field for life that requires a fair number of very domestic skills. So I think I would agree with you, Isabel, in this sense that we shouldn't neglect. I mean, let's push it to the extreme. Let's just say the woman never gets married and ends up having a peculiar calling of the Lord. She's still going to need those skills, right? So regardless of how we view women in higher education, we can't neglect reality. And that is that this is a high probability preparation. Fourth, our attitude. And I think this is key. I'm not going to say the following so that you agree with me. I'm simply going to state it as a personal conviction my wife and I have. We believe that depending on what our daughters are studying, we're of the conviction that much of higher education is never gone to waste. If you're careful as to what you select to study, it will very likely be woven by the Lord into some facet of your life at some point. I look back at my life, what does 4 years of pharmacy have to do with being a minister? Well, it has a lot to do with it. I wouldn't have connected the dots in my own head, but I've seen providentially how, when I'm working with people who are on medication, I have a great facility understanding what they're taking, what it does. I can look in the literature and understand what I'm reading. Now, I didn't know that was going to work out this way, that from pharmacy to education to ministry. But I look back and see how God wove so many different threads into what He eventually wanted me to do. I'm not saying that's a reason to put our girls in college. If there's this, if there's a sense of this, if this is covered, the attitude should be, at least in my view, education really doesn't go to waste unless it's a not good education. If it's putting you in your head all kinds of crazy things, that's another story. Second of all, I should continue this. Going into it with the understanding that if, and it's very likely God will, call you to marriage, then what you said, Michael, has to be there. And that is a willingness to suspend, or at least, you know, alter our understanding of our calling with respect to the other callings that God has for us. If God leads us to marriage, if God leads us to... It isn't like we're juggling all these callings. We have to do first things first and understand that it may mean that I'm no longer a teacher, that I'm this. We have a daughter, Martha, went through college, studied to be a teacher, got her certification. I don't believe she taught a day in her life, except in student teaching. She met her husband. They got married. Now, she does some teaching now, like in a homeschool group kind of a thing. So she's using her skill set as enabled. But right now, she's even putting that on the shelf because a second child is on the way. The responsibilities of her husband's ministry are you know, evolved. So her attitude towards her training is, hey, I invested money and time into this. I'm going to get something out. No. It's, I'm sensitive to the direction God's leading, and I follow that. So if husband and mother require X amount of time, I trust that God gave me skills and understanding for His wise purposes. And if nothing else, it'll help her in homeschooling, it'll help her with the homeschooling group. But she's not stressed out about the fact that she has this investment that she's not using in a career. Okay, so your attitude toward your education is very important. My wife dropped out of nursing school a year and a half in for me, to marry me. Now, you know, sometimes she thinks back, should I have finished that? Well, that's all water under the bridge. But I've said to her numerous times, none of that education went to waste. The skills, the working around people, the things that she did learn during that time have all been helpful throughout our married life. So she went into it with a loose grip, understanding that God's direction may be different in our lives. And that's the other thing. We have to guard against an investment mentality. I have known Christian gals who were tempted to delay childbearing so they could get a return on their investment. To put it in plain terms, they wanted to work a few years to make some money using the education they got, so her and her husband decided not to have children for a while. That's a whole other subject we can talk about, but I'm very uncomfortable with that. You know, now, if the husband's incapacitated, like was mentioned, and the woman has to try to supply some income, that's one thing. But if it's to maintain a certain lifestyle, if it's so that I feel fulfilled, you know, what happened to be fruitful and multiply? You know, we're starting to monkey with things for ulterior motives or for lesser than good motives. So we need to be very careful about this investment. I put this much in, I expect this much out. I think we can trust the Lord to follow Him, and that whatever life experiences we have, whether it's in college or in any other setting, God will put it to use. He plans the perfect plan for our life. Scott.
I think one thing that I've seen in college, and the people I know who've gone four to 6 years in college, is that usually the first 2 years of a four-year degree is basically a continuation of high school.
Yeah, gen ed.
So, you know, I look at young ladies who have an interest, who have a calling or a giftedness, and having number three staring them in the face.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, are they willing to forego 2 years of one thing and the attitude, okay, and, you know, I have no problem with them being using their giftedness and calling, but maybe instead of looking at the college system, look at trade schools or other type of schools.
Or self-education.
Self-education where they can get
the
last 2 years of college, the nuts and bolts of things.
Sure.
Get that into their finger grips before number three kicks in.
Yeah. I don't want to present a college or not learning.
Right.
There's a lot of alternatives, especially today. Yes, thank you. The last thing I want to mention here, just for consideration, is this. It does cost a bit of money to go to college. Is it a good investment? Now, we've been blessed greatly that, you know, every single one of our daughters had full scholarships to school. Otherwise, I'm not sure we would have, could have or would have afforded them to go. Our sons didn't have full scholarships, but I looked at that as they're preparing for their life's work. So my attitude toward their education, my wife and I's attitude, was a bit different than toward our daughter's education, obviously. So to us, the investment in dollars that our sons had to fork out was their investment in their calling. We don't pay for our children's education, even if it needs to be paid for. I'm not saying you can't, but to me, our obligation stopped at high school. We'll pay for everything up to that. But if you feel called, and I like to see you motivated partly by this, if it's something worthwhile, then you better pay for it or work out some arrangement. And quite frankly, we just couldn't afford it anyway, because college is very expensive these days. So, you know, this can sometimes come around to that. Part of the giftedness is, are you apt enough to be recognized by the school to get a scholarship? Maybe if not, and you're a lady, maybe that's saying something. I'm not saying it is necessarily, but it's something to think about. So, just so you realize, we're not independently wealthy and have loads and loads of money to spend on children's education. We actually haven't spent hardly a nickel. So that should be kept in mind too. This can be a big stumbling block. If you really don't have a sense of these things, if you really are looking, like you said, staring this in the face, does this make any sense? You know, especially if it's coming out of your pocket and you go into a bunch of debt and it's not looking like you're ever going to be using it in any realistic way. Okay, I think we better break. We're kind of way over. But if you have questions, if you have, you can push back on any of this stuff. This isn't, you know, the gospel according to Pastor. This is just, you know, some ways of looking at some of these things. But I think they're good things to talk about, because a lot of us have children that are getting older. Good things to share wisdom concerning. Let's pray.